Okay, welcome back. Hope you had a pleasant lunch. Kind of remarkable to actually have some warm weather. I thought it had been banned from the Bay Area. Or maybe it just seems warm because it's been so cold. Well, it might be warm in here too, and I actually told Kathy that I don't want her to use the air conditioning today. Because, first of all, if it's $10,000 a month for the water, who knows how much the air conditioning is. But practicing with a little bit of physical discomfort, nothing heavy, not masochism, but a little bit, can be helpful. Because essentially it's just it's creating just a little tension. And since this practice is so much about letting go and about confronting our own limitations or our own challenges, to kind of intentionally put slight challenges there is one way of kind of expanding your practice or expanding what is comfortable for you. My early practice, a lot of the time was spent in the Southern California high desert. And there were some retreats where I'd just be sitting and sweating. And the good thing about that was that it really got me in my body. You know, I could really feel my body. It just really felt very present, and so I hope you don't mind. I'm not trying to mess with you or anything. So what I plan this afternoon is that I'm going to talk a bit about the second noble truth, maybe the third noble truth, and then we'll have a sitting, and maybe a little stretch break in there, and then probably some interactive exercises, and onward from there. I don't like to plan too far in advance, but so I'm not going to ask you to maintain silence, except for that during the sitting periods, of course. And I, you know, typically I like after lunch to sit again, but I'm also aware of how immediately after eating, if we come into the meditation hall and close our eyes, oftentimes the mind also closes down and the body nods off. So I'm going to, as I said, talk a little bit about the second noble truth, which is the cause of suffering. This is, for me, this is kind of the brilliant insight and counterintuitive flash that the Buddha had. You know, if the Four Noble Truths are like a four-act play, the first noble truth is setting up the situation, and then the second noble truth is the twist. And because it's surprising when he says that, you know, we think, well, what's the cause of suffering? Well, it's all this stuff, you know, because I can't get anything right. Things aren't, you know, I keep being uncomfortable and I have all these thoughts and these emotions and I don't have enough money, you know. I mean, if I just had everything, if I could just get everything in line, then I wouldn't have these problems. And, you know, the Buddha just kind of slaps you across the face. No, you have it like backwards. Turn around. It's the craving, it's the thinking that it's not right that's the problem. It's the thinking that I need all those things to be right. It's the desire to have all that stuff be just that way that's the problem. Wow. What, you know, how kind of out of the blue that insight comes to me. Maybe it's obvious to others. So it's this our cravings in the many forms they take, each each feeling of desire has this subtext which says, if you take care of this, if you'll just satisfy this craving, then you'll be okay. Really, I'll leave you alone after that. Trust me. Well, this is why, you know, this is called Mara, the tempter. Lead us not into temptation. And it makes sense, so it's logical. Of course, there's some lack. I should fill the lack, fulfill this need. But what the brilliance of the Buddha is seeing that no matter what you get, it's going to change. And so that any sense of satisfaction, because the satisfaction, that word implies a finality or a stasis. You've arrived, you're done. Any possibility of arriving or being done is blown out of the water when you realize that everything is constantly changing. You have lunch, you're satisfied until you're hungry again. You have dinner, you're satisfied until you're tired and you want to go to bed. Yeah, it's just, these things just come continuously. I mean, you could track your day by the arising of desire and the effort to eradicate it, the arising of the next desire. So the feeling, this subtext that you're going to be satisfied is delusion. This is a delusion that our minds create. And when we see that we can't arrive somewhere, then what we want to do is start to confront the desire itself. So this is, again, one of the elements of practice. One of the core elements of practice is to watch desire appear and then to let it go. When you come back to your breath, essentially all you're doing is letting go of some desire. And each time you do that, you're undermining that habit. The way karma works, the law of karma, the law of cause and effect, is that the more you do something, the more you reinforce the tendency to do that. The less you do something, the more you undermine the tendency to do that. So the more you act on desire, guess what? The more desires you have. Sound familiar? One drink is too much, 1,000 isn't enough. Right? The more you drink, the more you want. The more you take drugs, the more you eat, whatever your addiction is there ever enough sex? You know, it's just, it's never enough, right? I mean, I love the image of, you know, after sex, a cigarette. Because, sex wasn't enough, you know. Now I need some more pleasure. You know. For those of you who remember sex. The aging of the Sangha. Okay. Just watch an old French movie, you'll get it back. So this, the more we act on desire, the more it's going to be just fed. So we act on desire less, and then there's less desire. It doesn't come up as much. Again, very counterintuitive. You think, well, the less I do something, the more I'm going to want to do it. But no, it doesn't quite work like that. And it's very interesting that, the monastics, they only eat usually one meal a day, or all their eating is before noon. And I've been on, I guess, just one monastic retreat. That was good. But I was a little intimidated. Oh, we're not going to eat after noon, you know. And I had tried to do that on a retreat that wasn't a monastic retreat, where some people were still eating, and so it just was really hard. I went on this monastic retreat, and I took along my little emergency supply of food, because that's how I am. Fear dominates. You know, after the first day, I had, like, late in the afternoon, I had, like, a cough drop. That was it. I mean, I wasn't hungry anymore afternoon. And it was just kind of, there's no meal served. And you just kind of, you're not acting on desire. You're not thinking about it. You're not planning. It's just not built in. And it's amazing. It just fell away. This is, I think, one of the reasons why the Buddha set up the monastic rules in this way, just to discourage desire, set up fewer sensual pleasures, fewer things to crave. The less we do, the less we act on desire, the less desire there is, to some extent. I mean, obviously, there's times when the desire is just going to arise, because of the conditioning, of our a lifetime's conditioning. But certainly many people who stop drinking and using find the same thing, that it's not like, you know, they're craving drinking. And when you think about when you were in your addiction, it felt like you had to do this like every day or regularly. Right? That the craving that would come up was just compelling, and it had to be acted on. And isn't it sort of miraculous that you could stop and then it wouldn't come back? Just out of curiosity, how many people here don't experience regular cravings for their drug of choice on a regular basis? Right. That's a great majority of the people here. The rest of you, I hope, are newcomers. But I know that for some people that's not true. And I have a good friend who's been sober, I guess she's a year ahead of me, so 27 years now, who says that she still gets cravings. And that's just, you know, that's true for some people. But for many of us, just stopping, the craving goes away. I mean, you got to think about that, you know. Sort of doesn't make sense, but it does in this model, this karmic model. So getting back to, as we're sitting in practice, another way that I think that meditation practice is playing a trick on us, or is doing things that we don't exactly see, is that when you just sit down and close your eyes and decide, I'm going to sit here for, you know, 10 minutes, and you close your eyes, no matter what happens, you don't act on the desire. So any desire that comes up is diffused. You've let go of it. So right there in that 10 minutes, you have done a certain amount of chipping away at the karma of craving. You've weakened craving in yourself. Now, you will notice that when you do this, sometimes your head starts to go crazy. And if you come on a retreat, as I know some of you have, go on a silent retreat, and particularly the beginning of the retreat, the mind is just creating all these stories and worries and plans, and it's kind of out of control. And what it's kind of doing, I think, is trying to make up for the fact that you're not acting on any craving. So it's creating all these mental cravings. But after a while, as you keep coming back to the breath, because each time you come back to the breath, you're letting go of craving, then it just undermines that. And after a few days of sitting, you can really settle into an amazing place of spaciousness and calm, and really reduced desire. Now, there can arise, when we start to study this or think about this, this idea that, oh, well, since we're letting go of desire, what we're supposed to do, if we're really good meditators, is not have any desires. And that's typical alcoholic thinking, basically. Take it to the extreme. Right? Now, yeah, sure, in the text it says that, you know, free from desire. And it says that when you're enlightened, then there isn't craving, all that. But I'm not sure about all that. I will say that at least they're partly kind of talking about certain types of desire. So one of the things I want to talk about is the types of the desire the Buddha is talking about here. But to complete this thought, we have to be very careful that we don't get into this perfectionism in meditation practice. We can bring that same kind of perfectionism that we bring to our disease or our addiction or whatever that personality trait is for addicts that wants to control everything. We come into meditation, we want to control our meditation. Oh, how do I do this? You know, so often, many of the questions I get about meditation are really about how can I control this? Oh, I'm falling asleep, what should I do? Oh, if I'm having pain, what can I do? How do I stay with my, how do I let go of these thoughts? How do I get rid of these thoughts? All about control. Right? Coming in and meditating is really about letting go of control. And that's what's scary about it. But you're not letting go of that much control. And in fact, just as it says, I'm thinking there's something in the 12-step literature about this, but I'm not hearing exactly in my mind what it is, so I might be making that up. It's the St. Francis prayer. It's by dying that we're awakened to the, anybody?
Eternal life.
Eternal life, right. It's that by letting go of control is how we actually gain larger control. It's turning your will and your life over to a higher power, but the higher power is not actually something out there. It's actually the power of the Dharma, the power of mindfulness, the power of compassion, those powers that are not personal powers, that don't belong to you, but nonetheless are part of you and which you can cultivate and operate from. That's not too vague an image. This is my afternoon tea. I don't drink caffeine in the morning, but I've taken up afternoon caffeine. So sometimes I get excited when I have my afternoon tea. So. Helps me get around the 18 holes, though. So it's... Now let me talk about the forms of desire that the Buddha talked about, because this is an important distinction to make as well. It's not that when we translate the literature, we can get into these very narrow understandings of what's being said. It's not so much that the Buddha said the cause of suffering is desire, but he's really talking about certain types of desire. And he used the word tanha, which the literal translation of that is thirst, which is sort of ironic. But he said the cause of suffering was thirst. And most Dharma teachers will just brush past that one quickly. But we can just say that that's it, yeah. We've arrived. But he talks about three types of desire. The desire for sensual pleasure, which is pretty evident, that relationship to addiction, and it's pretty evident the unsatisfactoriness of that how that really is not a way to achieve happiness by satisfying sensual desires. As you're aging, you certainly see that, but just eating too much popcorn is a way to see that there's just sort of no I guess that's from going to the movies last night, but there's no pleasure that's going to resolve anything. We understand it's temporary. There's nothing wrong with it. And the Buddha doesn't say that we shouldn't have pleasure. This is also a very important point. He agrees that there are sensual pleasures. He says the problem really isn't, pleasure isn't the problem. It's your attachment to it. It's your craving for pleasure that's the problem. So enjoy, you know, enjoy your food. Enjoy whatever pleasures you're having. Don't become attached to them. Don't let them become addictions. Don't let them become lead to more suffering. But in the present moment, enjoy them. And most of the time, we don't. You know, most of the time, we're hurrying on to the next thing so much that we don't enjoy the present moment pleasure. So enjoy the present moment pleasure, but don't seek after that as an answer to the deeper hungers. So there's the sensual pleasure. And then there's two other forms of desire. The desire, it's called the desire to be, and the desire to not be. Let's take a little bit more elaboration. This is about, largely about ego, the desire to sort of be somebody, to have an identity, to be recognized, to be the center of attention. I can't understand people who want that. It's just beyond me. This is kind of the life force in a way, that craving to live forever. It's interesting to me, when I was, I guess in my late teens, my parents had some friends over for cocktails. And this was the late 60s, and I think I was speaking in kind of apocalyptic terms about what was going on in the world, which wasn't probably inappropriate at the time. And this woman who was a friend of my parents said to me, you know, every generation thinks they're going to be the last one. And that really struck me, and it stayed with me, how each generation has these apocalyptic visions. And this is what I think that's about. We can't imagine the world going on without us. We would rather have the world end. If I have to go, everybody has to go. It really is that delusion. How can it go on? Well, oh, I know. I think the world's going to come to an end. No, just you. No, of course, we're each going to come to an end. So there's craving to be, you know, there's that tied up with genetics, with the craving of the species to continue to reproduce. And you notice Buddhist monks, you know, don't have sex, so they kind of intervene in that too. Although there's plenty of, I mean, the Buddha had a son, so anyway, let's not go there. And the desire to not be, interesting one that I've contemplated a bit, because it kind of confused me when I first heard it, and I won't say that I have an absolute handle on its meaning, but there's a few ways to look at it. One is the desire to annihilate consciousness, which is one of the desires that comes with addiction. You know, going into a blackout. The heroin addict certainly trying to really die, in a sense, just the desire to go to sleep. Oh, if I could just go to sleep. The desire to shut out consciousness. The kind of overwhelm of life, it's just too much. I just want to shut down. And the desire for annihilation. So all of these cause us suffering, these forms of sensual desire, mental, emotional craving. So, but it's important to distinguish that there are also forms of wanting or motivation that are skillful, that are wise, that are leading to the end of suffering. So the Buddha talks about the desire that leads to suffering, but that there's also a desire that leads to the end of suffering, or that leads to the end of desire. I mean, why would you come up here today to sit in this chair and just do nothing if you didn't have some desire? And is that a destructive, if there's something destructive about that? I don't think so. This is the wise wishes, Buddhadasa calls it. There's foolish desires and wise wishes. So an important piece of our practice, of our mindfulness practice, is to be able to distinguish these things. It's easy for us to delude ourselves into what is a wise wish that might actually be a foolish desire. At the same time, we need to be able to trust our sense of longing for connection or longing for spiritual growth or for change, and to say we're going to take this risk or try out this practice. It can lead to suffering. There's no doubt. There's times when this longing for freedom or for awakening can step over into, I really want to get enlightened because it's going to solve all my problems. Or, you know, if I could just get, you know, maybe I should just become a monk because then I won't have all this, you know, all these issues to deal with. And we can see that kind of how even in skillful, when there's a skillful end in mind, we can get caught in an unskillful energy moving toward it. So in Buddhism, the end does not justify the means. The means is everything. It's in fact, the means, it's the quality of the means that determines the quality of the ends. So you can't separate the two. Well, that gives us, I think, some of a sense of the second noble truth. So I'd like to do some sitting. And I'd like to really encourage you then, during this sitting, to notice everything that interferes with your attention to the breath or to the present moment. And notice if there is a quality of desire or craving or attachment in that interference, in that thing that's interfered. So it sort of adds a little piece to your practice, if you haven't already done this kind of practice, where you're sitting, following your breath, and then you realize, oh, I'm thinking. So then just for a moment, there's a couple of ways to approach this. You can just feel the energetic quality that has come from the thought. That's pretty subtle. Or you can just look at what was that thought and notice if there was some desire. And there can be the opposite of desire, which the flip side, aversion or just not wanting, which is the same thing. It's just all one type of energy, wanting or not wanting, just moving two different directions. Just notice, you can either notice the content of it, oh, that's what I was thinking about, wow, really, okay, that was a desire. Or you can just notice, how does that feel? Ooh, sheesh, oh, and that kind of yuck. Okay, so let's sit. And I'll give a little guidance just to get us settled, and then I'll quiet down. Oh, beginning by connecting with your body, with your posture, with any obvious tension or strong sensations. Relaxing.